This is Open Air on the Rhythm and News service of Jefferson Public Radio. We're also streaming live online at www.ijpr.org. We've got another live session for you today, and it is a good one. Joining me in the JPR studios is Mr. Bela Fleck. Welcome to JPR.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
Many years have gone by since we last talked. It was nearly 20 years ago, mid-90s. It was right around the time that Tales from the Acoustic Planet Volume 1 came out, right in the middle of a tremendous run of albums with Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. Lots of things have happened for you over the next 18 years. I want to talk about some of them today.
Okay.
But as a place to start, is it true that it was Earl Scruggs that got you interested in banjo?
Absolutely. I first heard Earl Scruggs on the Beverly Hillbillies television show. And I was a kid growing up in Queens, New York. And so there was no cultural reference for me. It was just the sound. You know, what is that sound? And it turns out that almost all of the banjo players that I know that are five-string, three-finger players had an awakening moment that involved Earl Scruggs. Mm. Not other, as many great banjo players as there are out there, it's almost Earl Scruggs that triggers the banjo reflex for somebody who makes them actually go get one.
And he is the guy that is really known for that style of picking, correct?
Well, he's the one who really got known for this. They call it three-finger style because you revolve your thumb and your two first fingers on your right hand. And because you're alternating those three fingers, no finger is playing that fast. So you can play incredibly fast or have the illusion of playing super, super fast with almost no motion. And it was kind of like an amazing moment when he discovered that. Now, it's not that other people hadn't used three fingers before or even around the same time. It's just that not only did he figure it out for himself, but he was a phenomenal musician, and so his music spoke to people, and therefore all these people followed his lead.
Bela Fleck is my guest live on Jefferson Public Radio. A few months ago, Tony Trischka was here with a small group, and I know he is a guy that you refer to a lot as being early on one of your teachers and mentors. Tell me about the time that you spent learning from Tony.
Oh, man, Tony's the best. I just love Tony. So after getting turned on to Earl Scruggs, I went and found a banjo teacher in New York, and he was a guy named Eric Darling who was had played with a band called the Weavers. He was coming out more of a folk tradition kind of player, but once he saw that I was kind of getting fancy fast, I was growing fast as a banjo player. He sent me to a guy named Mark Horowitz who played all kinds of styles of banjo, including Bill Keith's style and melodic style, single string, Reno, everything, all the banjo styles that were happening then. And he turned me on to this guy called Tony Trischka. He said, well, you have to check this stuff out. This is the new cat. And so it got to be to where all I was doing was asking Mark to teach me Tony Trischka's stuff. Mm. And one day he said, listen, here's his phone number. Stop bothering me. And so I discovered that like the greatest banjo player of the time and still one of the greatest banjo players ever lived in the Bronx, not very far from where I lived in Manhattan. And I started going up and taking lessons from him. And I became a Tony Trischka clone. I mean, literally to the point where we'd be at a party and we'd be jamming and people would close their eyes and not know which one was which. And at a certain point, I realized that I wasn't going to get anywhere by being a Tony Trischka look-alike, sound-alike. So I started trying to change my sound from his, look for all the possible ways that I could be different from him that felt natural to me. And then I started pursuing a lot of areas that he wasn't particularly following.
When you were coming up, what was advancing more rapidly, your actual proficiency on the instrument or your desire to expand beyond traditional modes of playing banjo?
Well, I think it all came at the same time. Like, I didn't have the brains to play jazz, but I also didn't have the technique when I started, but I had the desire. So I was learning it, I would learn a few Charlie Parker licks, and then I'd learn them all over the banjo, and that kept me going for 6 months. And then I'd go hear Pat Martino play electric guitar, and I'd try to learn one of his great licks and learn it on the banjo, and it took me forever trying to play a Chick Corea solo from a tune called Spain. I never, ever was able to completely learn it, but it inspired me. And then, 20, 30 years later, I had some of the tools, but it was sort of a lifelong closet jazz player, wishing I was a jazz player, mm-hmm. thinking it might not ever work out.
Was Tony your initial door into playing professionally?
Well, a bit. I mean, in that I was already playing a lot in high school and making money doing it, so I guess I was already professional, but one of the first actual full-time gigs I got was one that he turned down for a band called Tasty Licks up in Boston, because Tony wasn't going to move to Boston to play in this band, but it was a really good band, and he said, well, how about this banjo student of mine? Maybe he'd be
a good guy. A lot like me.
Yeah, right. You want me? You can't get me, but you can get this guy. And so I ended up moving to Boston. It was a great, great thing.
You're now, what, 25 years into Bela Fleck and the Flecktones, which is a band that from its inception has been slightly outside of all categories, all styles, a melding of just about anything. Looking back on it from today's perspective, what do you think the legacy is going to be of that band as it sits in the musical world?
Oh, that's a good question. And golly, I don't know if I'm the right person to ask it, really, because you know, you just do it, and then the chips fall where they may. But I would say that the band has a time and a place. Like, in other words, the Flecktones right now, if we started now, it would be a different time and place. When we came up, and starting in the late 80s and in the early 90s, there was certain doors that we were bashing on, you know, and structures we were fighting against and pushing against. And everybody had a way of playing that nobody had really ever heard before. Like, so put four guys like that together, we were able to do a lot of damage. But it also was connected to that time, like that early 90s. That was when the Flecktones sort of came out of nowhere and made a big sound. And then you have like, well, how do you, you know, carry a group like that on for 25 years? And you have to keep on really being serious about making sure the band's always fresh and doing material that's challenging to everybody and that we live up to the ideals that we started with. And so that's, I mean, it's not really a challenge in that everybody wants it, but it's a challenge because it takes work to do it.
Is there still more Flecktones music out there to be created?
To be created, I certainly hope so, and it appears that we will. In the last few years, we've gone into a sort of on and off mode. So, like, one year we'll go out and do a bunch of stuff, and then we'll clear out space because if the Flecktones are playing, then all of our solo projects have to go dormant because the Flecktones will sort of sweep it away. People say, "Well, we want the Flecktones. We don't want you with the string quartet or Victor with his band or you know whatever all the other things." So. So at this point, after doing it for so long, everybody's eager to have other experiences as well, and yet we love the band. So I think the next time we're likely to get together will probably be in another year or two, and then hopefully we'll do another big, you know, a new album or a big tour or something to make it special to us that's not just the same thing we've always done. You know, we wouldn't go out and just play the old songs, for instance. We'd have to have some new angle on it.
Cool.
But we will. I feel very, you know, certain that we will.
Bela Fleck is my guest live in the JPR studios. You have brought in a couple of banjos. What do you want to play first today?
Well, I thought maybe I could start out with some African tunes. I had this incredible experience of going to Africa, to four countries in Africa, and making a film and a record called Throw Down Your Heart. And I was kind of searching for some of the roots of the banjo.
You mean it's not the American South?
Well, no, not exactly. The banjo's got a varied and rich history, and depending on what you actually call a banjo, they exist in every part of the world. But West Africa is really where it came to the United States from. So I really enjoyed getting to go play with a lot of those folks over there. I'm going to play a couple tunes, maybe three little tunes. One is actually from Tanzania. It's played on a marimba, but it just sounds good on the banjo. And then a couple from Mali. Thank you.
That is Bela Fleck live on Jefferson Public Radio. Well, before the tune, which was incredible, by the way, we were talking about Flecktones music and then solo projects. And your solo projects have gone in every imaginable direction, including the African music that you recorded for Throw Down Your Heart. When you're out touring in various group configurations, duos with Chick Corea or with Abigail or with the Flecktones, what are the demands like for you to remember all of that repertoire?
Well, you know, once I'm on tour doing a set of material, I'm safe. The problem comes when I have like one show with Chick Corea, and the next day I have to play the symphony piece, the concerto, and then the next day I have to play with the string quartet. There's this whole other set of music I do with a group called Brooklyn Rider. So that can be a little bit of a tough few days because it's a lot of material to keep current. But generally, once I get going, I'm in there, you know. And I mean, I do practice a lot, and I practice more as I'm getting older. I want to be good. I don't want to get out there and scuffle around and stink. And especially the people that I play with are really intense, great musicians. Like another one is Edgar Meyer and Zakir Hussain. We did a bunch of touring together, and played Brit, and these guys are some of the greatest musicians in the world. So I gotta be on my game. And sometimes going back and forth, the great thing about doing lots of different stuff is that I'm fresh. Like I'm not just doing this one thing. So that means I'm getting ideas from the other thing I was doing. I get ideas from the African stuff and try it with Zakir. I get ideas playing with Chick Corea and try it with the Flecktones and anything that... The fun thing, actually playing with Abby is one of the easiest things that I do, but it's also one of the ones that I have the most freedom in because she tends to like... lock these grooves down. And she's a clawhammer player, which is more of a groove. She's got a groove personality. She wants to make the beat and get a good sound. And I'm much more of an improviser. So she locks it down and sings these beauty with this gorgeous voice and these great original songs. And then I just kind of do whatever I want. And it's really refreshing. It's a nice change from everything else that I do.
I'm glad you brought up playing with Abigail because I'm curious, what does a Bela Fleck, Abigail Washburn concert sound like? What's the repertoire like? What do you guys run through?
Oh, gosh. What do we do? We do a good number of tunes from Abby's world because she's got to sing them and she's got to know them. But we also do a lot of traditional songs. And oddly enough, that's been a hole in my pie, I guess. I don't know quite how to put it. I haven't been doing much traditional stuff since Newgrass Revival, and honestly, I miss it. So there's more of a little bit of a traditional element, although it's an easygoing tradition. I can do pretty much anything that I want, but we're going to play some traditional stuff. And then we do a few Chinese songs because Abby sings those. And then there's some songs that we're writing. We're working on a new album. We've actually got 14 tracks down already, and we're going to pick out which ones make a great album, to what we think is a great album, and put that out in the fall. So it's a lot of different things. But then also there's always a point where I get to go off and do the stuff that maybe Abby can't do with me, like some of these classical pieces or some solo stuff.
Is there a kind of music that challenges you most?
Everything challenges me.
Well, you don't ever seem to play anything that's easy.
Yeah.
You know, from time signatures, key signatures, music from different cultures and different musical languages. There doesn't seem to be much that's simple in your repertoire.
Well, I'd say probably playing with Abby is actually not as hard as anything else that I do. And when I play bluegrass, occasionally, at least once a year, I play bluegrass with people like Sam Bush and Jerry Douglas, Stuart Duncan, folks like that, and Brian Sutton. And that, actually, when you don't play bluegrass all year, even playing bluegrass can be stressful because I want it to be good if I'm playing with those guys.
Yeah, absolutely. Bela Fleck is my guest live in the JPR studios. You got something else to play for us? What do you want to do next?
I was going to say, you're talking about what's the most stressful for me is playing set music where every single note is written out. And that's the hardest because everybody knows when you screw up a Bach piece. So why don't I take a shot at a Bach piece and see if I can avoid screwing it up on the radio?
That is music from Johann Sebastian Bach. It's Bela Fleck live in the JPR studios. Bela for Bartok, Anton for Weber, and Lajos for Janáček. Was this sort of a predetermined outcome that you would end up making classical music at some point?
Well, I guess so, because it happened, right? So up till now, I couldn't have told you whether it was predetermined because it hadn't happened. But now it looks like I'm actually finding a home in the classical world as a composer-performer. Person.
And you grew up in a household, stepdad was a cellist.
Yeah, my stepfather played the cello in the 7th Army Symphony. And but I got the names from my father, and that's a complicated story. My mom and dad split up when I was one, and he was not around. So after giving all those names, that was the end of the influence, really.
There must have been something there.
Yeah.
And he must have known classical music well enough.
Yeah.
Or loved it well enough to impart those names.
Yeah, my poor brother got the name Ludwig. But yeah, so my friend Edgar Meyer was really the door that opened classical music to me. Although my stepfather played chamber music around the house and I heard it a lot, I never really had any connection to it in terms of me playing it. I just was aware of it. And some of it I liked and some of it I thought was kind of sleepy. But then I saw Edgar Meyer play, and then somebody of my own generation was playing it at a level that was so superb that I realized that classical music was a lot more than I had realized.
He had recorded the Bach cello suites.
He did it a little bit later, bass, yeah, after we got to know each other. Yeah, I saw him go through that. I saw him premiere his first concerto. And Edgar, if for folks that don't know Edgar, he's just one of these genius cats. And he grew up in Knoxville. His father was a jazz bass player and a classical bass player. And Edgar kind of learned everything from his father and went to the moon with it. And he became an incredible composer. You might know him from the work that he's done with Yo-Yo Ma, or all the different great collaborations he's done with Chris Thiele. And
it's part of the Goat Rodeo Sessions.
Exactly.
Right?
That's one of them. Mm-hmm.
This concerto of yours is by no means your first foray into classical music. You had recorded Perpetual Motion, which was a series of shorter pieces a number of years back. You co-wrote With Edgar, a concerto for banjo and bass, is that right?
That's right, and also a triple concerto with Edgar and Zakir, which were both for Nashville Symphony.
But this is really the first time where you are the single soloist up there on stage.
Right, well, there's the soloist aspect, and then there's the composing aspect, because it's one thing to write a piece with Edgar, you know, who knows, he's got your back, he knows how this whole thing is going to work, and I didn't grow up in the world of composition or understand that music very well. So to me, it was pretty frightening to go and do it by myself. But I felt like I had to, because I couldn't always have Edgar, you know, steer the ship. At some point, I had to grow up and do it. And still, there hadn't been a standalone banjo concerto.
Why?
Why? Well, I think it's not fair to say that there hadn't been one. I say there hadn't been one that was the kind of one I wanted to play. Mm. Like, I know there was one written by a banjo player in Kentucky named Tim Lake, probably in the 80s, maybe even the 70s. But that was built around his style of playing. And then there was one written for Pete Seeger in the early 70s that he never even played, because I think he realized it wasn't something he felt comfortable doing. And Eric Weisberg played it one time. And I heard that piece, and it's a cool piece, but it didn't feel like it wouldn't showcase the way I play. You know what I mean? So to write sort of a current banjo concerto that allowed me to show off what I did in a classical context and allowed me to collaborate with classical musicians, it just hadn't been done yet.
And what'd you call it?
I called it The Imposter.
Why?
Well, I live life as an imposter because I'm often playing with the banjo in places that it isn't typically found. Mm. So it sort of came to me as I was finishing up the piece that's what this piece was about, the idea of a banjo masquerading in an orchestra as if it was supposed to be there. You know, you walk out in a tux and you sit down in the center of the orchestra and start playing and nobody says anything, right? But the truth is, somebody at any moment could say, "What are you doing here? Get out of here immediately. You do not belong here." So there's always that fear that somebody's going to say that at some point.
Tell me the story of who you dedicated it to.
Yeah, I dedicated it to Earl Scruggs, who
seems fitting.
Is my hero for so many reasons, and also because this is one of the things that he never got to do. And I had talked to him. We lived a few miles apart for quite a while, for the last 10 or 12 years, and got to be really good friends, which I'm really thrilled about. So I dedicated the piece to him, and he came to the premiere, which was incredible. He came to the show. It was the last concert he came to before he passed away. And he seemed to really like it.
How much improv is in it for you?
No improv.
Really? It's all written out?
It's all written out. And I decided to do that because the whole point of composing a piece like this is to see what you can come up with that you could not improvise. So even with all the banjo cadenzas and all the banjo featured things, they're unconventional. They may not sound as unconventional as they are. They're in odd keys. There are open strings that I'm using as pathways to different positions. Things that I could never think of as fast as I would need to play them off the top of my head. They have to be practiced. There's things where I have two voices moving at the same time that can only be mapped out carefully with a pencil, figuring out what's within your grasp and how to keep the two lines moving, almost by trickery, by, again, using open strings occasionally to switch position seamlessly. So things like that, I thought there were things that I could learn. And also because I improvise so much of the time, and this was not why I was playing classical music, is to improvise. I was trying to actually do a legitimate banjo concerto that was written out. So that's what I did this time. Now, that doesn't mean that another time I might not write a piece for banjo and orchestra or other classical ensemble that I could improvise in, because that would be a whole different piece now that I've done this.
Bela Fleck is my guest live on Jefferson Public Radio. A number of years ago, Chick Corea released the Mozart Sessions, where he was playing some Mozart piano concerti. And I remember being in a discussion with some staunch classical fans about his improvisation or interpretation of the Mozart. When you talk about circling back around 30 years later to traditional bluegrass, do you, with as many things as you have absorbed and as many styles as you have learned to play, do you have the ability to continue playing traditional bluegrass without all of those other things seeping back in?
Oh, it's really fun. I mean, it's fun to play bluegrass because it's the one area where I know exactly what the banjo is supposed to do. Hmm. Like every other, back to the imposter issue, every music that I play in, there's some guesswork involved. Like how should a banjo play in an African group? How should a banjo play in a string quartet? How should a banjo play in a jazz group? And how should I play with an Indian musician? And all the time, you know, there's some percentage of that I must be getting wrong because I'm just guessing the whole time. But when I play bluegrass, I have such a knowledge of how people have played the banjo in a bluegrass band from the very beginning. I know every banjo player. I know, you know, how Earl played it. I know how Don Reno played it. I know how Sonny Osborne played it. I know how J.D. Crowe played it. I know how Bill Keith played it. I know how Alan Mundy played it. I know how Tony Trischka played it, and on and on and on. So when I just play bluegrass, I can sort of choose freely what I'm going to play based on all these options. And then the other thing I would say is that music grows when you bring things in from outside of it. And like jazz is a great example of that, in that almost all of the great changes in jazz came when somebody brought something in from outside of it. And I think that's true of bluegrass too. You know, as all of these different banjo players came in with new ideas, you know, even Don Reno, like the second super famous banjo player, had a totally different take on it than Earl Scruggs, and he was listening to a lot of music outside of bluegrass, and he brought that in. And when you think about, you know, Coltrane Coltrane, like listening to Indian music and all the spiritual music and bringing that into jazz and sort of starting this whole new branch of jazz, in some ways, the best way to invigorate a music is to have fresh blood. And so when I made Bluegrass Sessions in 1996, I had waited a long time since I made the last bluegrass record, and I waited almost intentionally till I felt like I had something different to offer the music. And I came up with some different ideas from all the other experiences that I'd had about what I wanted to do in a bluegrass context. So that's a long run-on answer to what you're saying. Yeah. is yes. Yes, I love playing just like Earl Scruggs when I get a chance to, but I also am looking for the things I can do that don't stop it from being bluegrass, but give it some fresh energy.
Bela Flack is my guest live on Jefferson Public Radio. Before I let you go, is it possible for us to hear a little bit of that concerto?
Yeah, sure. I'll play you some of the second movements. And these, of course, will be solo bits that are usually played by myself or with a few other instruments surrounded by pieces that feature just the orchestra. So it'll be, let's call it excerpts from the second movement. Thank you.
Music from The Impostor, the Concerto for Banjo and Orchestra of Bela Fleck, live on Jefferson Public Radio. Well, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you, and thanks for coming and visiting with us.
Yeah, my pleasure.